guys, welcome back to another episode of Apologia TV. That's what you're watching right now. You can get us at apologiaradio.com, A-P-O-L-O-G-I-A, radio.com. That's where you guys get us, get more. You get the past episodes, the podcast, the TV show, the after show, everything. And so welcome to Apologia TV. And for those of you guys that are big fans of Apologia TV, you may recognize that this is an entirely new situation happening right here. We are in our makeshift studio right now because we are building a nighttime talk show where the studio used to be. Well, I should say we.
French.
I shouldn't have said
really
that.
I didn't know you spoke French.
By the way, this is the bear right here, Pastor Luke.
That's why I'm wearing a sawdust hat. Don't look at my hat. It's got sawdust.
Don't look at me.
I forgot my clean clothes.
Don't look at me. I'm Jeff the Common Ninja. That's Joy the girl right there.
Yes.
And Luke is actually building the studio for the stage for next week with Jeff Durbin. That is coming
not
soon.
Next week.
It's not starting next week. That's just the name of the show.
Right.
How's that coming along, Luke?
We will
Luke?
Tell you when it's happening next week.
Yes.
It's coming good. We're getting close.
Good. Well, while we're in here in this makeshift studio, we have actually a very special guest with us today, someone we actually really appreciate and love. And I'm going to actually play a video for you right now to introduce you to our guest.
For centuries, the Bible has been criticized by people who question the scientific accuracy of Genesis.
Science confirms that our world is special. God made the earth for life.
Dr. Jason Lyle, Director of Research at the Institute for Creation Research, is an astrophysicist and a Christian apologist who conducts scientific research through the lens of Scripture. His discoveries in solar astrophysics and general relativity confirm the Bible's divine claim of a created cosmos.
The methods by which we measure these galaxy distances are good scientific methods. They're not based on evolutionary assumptions. They're things that creationists and evolutionists would agree on.
Learn why the Big Bang Theory doesn't work. See the universe as Genesis correctly states it. Travel into the heavens with Dr. Jason Lyle.
All right, that's the introduction for Dr. Jason Lyle. He's the Director of Physical Sciences, Astronomy, Apologetics, and Physics with Institute for Creation Research. And he's the Director of Physical Science. Dr. Lyle leads ICR's gifted team of physical scientists who continue to investigate and demonstrate the evidence for creation. He graduated summa cum laude from Ohio Wesleyan University, where he double majored in physics and astronomy and minored in mathematics. He earned a master's degree and a PhD in astrophysics.
Physics.
It's been a long week.
You guys don't even know. At the University of Colorado, Dr. Lyle specialized in solar astrophysics and has made a number of scientific discoveries regarding the solar photosphere and has contributed to the field of general relativity. Wow.
Is that like Han Solo? Space?
I think it's a little different. We'll ask him about it right now. Okay. Dr. Lyle, welcome to Apologia TV, brother.
Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. So we've known about you for a long time. Really, really appreciate your work. Dr. Lyle, you have a book that's actually very, very popular, The Ultimate Proof of Creation. And this would be a good way to introduce you and to talk about your work and why we appreciate it so much. In The Ultimate Proof of Creation, you talk a lot about the preconditions of intelligibility, the foundation of logic, of uniformity in nature, all those things. And you're coming at all of this with a PhD in astrophysics, and you're a scientist, and you love science, and you love logic, and you love truth and rigorous thinking. And that really comes out in Ultimate Proof of Creation, that you need a foundation for all of those things. So can you talk to us about that? How, as a Christian, can you blend together a rigorous commitment to the scriptures and also be a scientist?
You know, I would argue that if you're going to be a rationally consistent scientist, if you're really going to be logical, you really have to be a consistent Christian, because the things that are necessary for science to work, for it to make sense, are precisely the things that are articulated in the Christian worldview. The fact that we expect there to be order in the universe, that's a prerequisite for science. It would make little sense to try and study the universe, try to find patterns in it, if there were no patterns in it, if it was just a cosmic accident, a result of Big Bang and what have you. On the other hand, if the universe is created by God, as the Bible teaches, then we would expect to find order and uniformity, a certain degree of uniformity in it. That's exactly what we find. Science is predicated on the fact that God upholds the universe in a consistent fashion, a fashion that our mind is able to understand, at least to some extent. And God made our, that makes sense. God made our mind. He made us able to be rational, to consider various options and choose the best. Science is predicated on all these things. The reliability of my senses, the fact that what I see and hear is basically accurate. It corresponds to reality. A Christian principle, that God made my eyes, he made my ears, and he designed them to probe the environment around me. And so I should expect they can do that accurately, perhaps not perfectly because of sin, but nonetheless, having been made in the image of God, I can probe the universe that he made and to some extent can understand it. And that's really what science is all about. It's the study of the way that God upholds the universe today. And it's really a shame that a lot of scientists have gotten away from the roots of science. They've forgotten what it is that makes science possible, namely the Christian worldview. And so they, you know, you hear a lot of secularists trying to use science inappropriately to argue against the Christian worldview when in fact shooting themselves in the foot, as it were, because if the Christian worldview were not true, science wouldn't even be possible in the first place. That's what we call a precondition of intelligibility, the fact that the universe has to be organized in order for science to be possible. But there are other ways that we rely on, other preconditions we rely on, the fact that the mind has the capacity to be rational, that we can consider logical propositions, that we can, using laws of logic, we can derive certain things from certain other things. And that makes sense if I'm made in the image of God. And if my mind is a finite reflection of his infinite mind, then of course it makes sense that I can do these things. But if none of those things make sense, if the universe is an accident, a result of a big bang, if I'm just the result of evolution, unplanned, no mind behind it, then there's no reason to expect that my senses would be reliable. And so all these things that make science and rationality and scholarship possible are things that are provided for in the Christian worldview and only the Christian worldview. And that's what my book Ultimate Proof is all about.
Yeah, highly recommend that book to all of you guys. If you don't have that in your library, you should have that in your library. And I think it's important to discuss that when you talk about astronomy, physics, when you talk about the study of the universe and science, scientific method, there are certain procedures within those pursuits that are a part of science and physics and those sorts of things. And in order to actually engage in those procedures in any meaningful way, you have to have a foundation to do it. And so when you talk about things like science, you need uniformity in nature. You need something called induction, that the future will be like the past. And the truth is without the God of the Bible, the triune God of Scripture, you can't actually engage those things in any meaningful or coherent way. You need God to make sense of science, to actually do it in a meaningful way. Be right back, guys. Apologia TV. Stay with us on the other side. Welcome back to Apologia TV, guys, in our makeshift studio here at Apologia Studios with the bear, the girl, and me. And Dr. Jason Lyle. We just finished up the last segment talking about something very, very important. That is that you need the God of the Bible. You need the triune God of Scripture to be able to engage in any meaningful way in things like logic, abstract, universal, unchanging, necessary laws, like laws of logic. You need that to do science. You need that to walk your dog. You need that to drive a car. You need those things, and you can't make sense of them with an atheistic framework. You can't make sense of that within a worldview that says all of us are bags of biological stuff, bipedal protoplasm, and a universe that doesn't care. If we're all cosmic accidents, how do we engage in laws? How do we engage in science? How do we trust in the future being like the past, which is necessary for science, for any kind of study, really anything you do? How do you actually engage in science without a commitment to integrity and truthfulness? And is that demanded? Do we demand that people have integrity? Is that necessary? Is there a moral obligation to have integrity when discussing evidence and truth and those sorts of things? And you need Jesus, ultimately, who is the foundation of wisdom. All the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are hidden in Christ, Paul says in Colossians chapter 2. And so that's what Jason talks a lot about. Jason, let me throw something at you so people can kind of get an idea of what we're talking about when we talk about the Word of God as the foundation, as the reference point. Recently, you have a physicist here at ASU. His name is Dr. Lawrence Krauss. He's a popular atheist and kind of a pop culture atheist. He just recently was on Joe Rogan's podcast. He was talking a lot about science and all these different things he was just taking for granted. Now, I'd like you to respond to this. He says, as a physicist, Dr. Lyle, that all the physical constants that we see in the universe around us are the result of sheer accident. So the physical constants are the result of accidents. And I want to ask you, as a scientist, as someone who has studied in this area, who knows what you're talking about, how do you respond to a person who is an atheist, who does who studies physics and teaches physics, but says that the universe is the result of accidents?
Well, yeah, I'm familiar with Lawrence Krauss, and he's a guy who really does not like God.
Right.
And for that reason, he really tries to argue against God. But it's interesting. His belief that the constants are merely accidents is not logical. It's not something that would a person would come to if you were thinking properly. There are certain constants in nature, like the electromagnetic constant. There's actually two constants there: the permittivity and permeability of free space, which determine the strength of electric fields and magnetic fields, and also determine the round trip speed of light. Now, these things have to be pretty close to the way they are, because if they weren't, matter couldn't exist. So, for example, the force of attraction that an electron feels as it orbits around the nucleus of an atom, you make that a little bit stronger and you can't have atoms, or you make it a little bit weaker and you can't have atoms, or you can maybe only have hydrogen. And so that's an example. If you want to have creations made out of matter, you got to have these constants be just right. Or the strong nuclear coupling constant, for example. Or the fact that the up quark weighs a little bit less than the down quark. If that were not the case, if down quarks were just a little bit heavier, then everything would decay into neutrons and you couldn't have atoms. And some of these are very tightly constrained. If they're just a little bit off one way or the other, then you can't have the universe as we know it, and you can't have life as we know it. Of course, I'm sure God has freedom in the kind of universe that he made, but it's interesting that it's very well designed for the life forms that he placed in it. And then, of course, I would remind Lawrence Krauss and others as well that once you reject the biblical worldview, you have no basis for believing in the scientific method by which you came to the conclusion that these constants are what they are. Because apart from the Christian worldview, you'd have no reason to think that your senses are reliable, or that nature is uniform, or that there are any patterns to be discovered at all, let alone these specific patterns that we find out in nature.
Exactly. All right, Joy?
Okay. So because I'm on the show, I get to ask my nerdy questions that I'm super interested in, and everyone gets to listen to them as the topic of the show. So
is it about sharks?
No, it's not. But other than the ocean, I would have to say that space is my other favorite place. It's a close second.
Space is my favorite.
I've never been there, though.
How do you know what's your favorite, then?
I've never been there. But that was a great little addition. But I've never been there.
I've been in the ocean, but never to space. I think what we're going to start with, the two things I'd like to talk to you about today are somewhat related. But I'd like to start out with let's phrase it this way. The distant starlight problem, which we don't think of as a problem, but maybe you can tell us why people think it's a problem and why it's not a problem.
Sure. Yeah. The problem, as people think it is, has to do with the fact that the universe is enormous. And of course, it's enormous. There's no doubt about that. The scientific method by which we measure distances to galaxies is very good. It's not very precise. We might be off by a factor of two, but we're not off by a factor of a million. And the galaxies really are very, very far away. So far away that light, even though it travels very fast, light travels 186,282 miles in 1 second. It could go around the Earth 7 times in 1 second. Wow. That's how fast light is. And yet these galaxies are so far away that even at the speed of light, it would take billions of years to get from the farthest galaxies to the Earth. And the fact is, we do see these galaxies, which means the light has gone from there and has reached the Earth. And so the conclusion that many people draw is, well, therefore, the universe is at least billions of years old, because otherwise, how would you see those galaxies? And so that's basically the starlight problem in a nutshell. How do you get the light from A to B in less time than seems possible? Because, of course, in the Christian worldview, the Bible tells us that God made everything, the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that's in them in 6 days. And it's clear from those genealogies that you love to read before you go to bed, and so-and-so begat so-and-so, you add up those ages. And you find a few thousand years ago that God created, not billions of years ago. So that's the distant starlight would seem to be a problem in the Christian worldview. Now, in terms of the solution, there have been many proposed, and I'll mention that some of the ones that seem the most simple solution, they really don't work. The idea that maybe the galaxies are really close, that just doesn't work. Or maybe light takes short through space. Well, there are good physical reasons to think that those don't work, and I won't go into a lot of detail on that, but I have to mention it. Otherwise, people will say, but have you thought of this?
Right.
And the answer is yes, we've thought of that, and it doesn't work. There's a reason. So we have to go into something a little more complex, and it involves the physics that Einstein discovered. And basically, one of the things that Einstein discovered, it's not one of his more well-known discoveries, but it is something that he wrote about, was the fact that the speed of light is only measurable objectively on a round trip. That is, if I were to take a light beam, shoot it out into space, bounce it off a mirror, and bring it back to its starting point, I could measure the time it takes to do that. I could divide by the distance, and that would give me an average speed. Now, many people assume that it takes the light the same time to go out as it does to come back, but it turns out that's not known, and in fact, it can't be known. God has structured the universe in such a way that it's impossible to know the speed of light in any one direction. You can only measure its round-trip speed, and so it could be that the speed when light is moving away from an observer is perhaps slower, and when it's coming toward an observer, perhaps faster. In fact, it can be up to infinitely fast when it's moving toward an observer. And this is something that, again, Einstein wrote about in his book on relativity. And if once you realize that when light is moving toward an observer, we don't know its speed. It could be up to infinity. Then that means there is no distant starlight problem. It means that even today, the light from those distant galaxies reaches Earth instantaneously, because it only has to make a one-way trip. It only has to get from there to here, and that is allowable within known physics. Now, the details are complicated, but that's basically what I think the answer is in a nutshell, and I think it's supported scripturally, because the Bible in Genesis 1, when it tells us that God made the lights in the heavens, one of their purposes was to give light on the earth, and it says, and it was so, which implies to me that God created those lights, and they immediately began giving light upon the earth, which means it took no time at all for the light from those galaxies to reach the earth. And we know of at least one way that God could have done that, and that is by virtue of the fact that the speed of light in one direction can be up to infinity, depending on how we choose to synchronize clocks. So that's a little bit complicated and a little bit counterintuitive, but it is something that is pretty well established in physics. It's called the conventionality thesis. And not everybody agrees on it, but most physicists would say it's pretty well established.
Interesting. All right, guys, stay with us. Very, very cool stuff here. Be right back, guys, with the bear, the girl, and myself, and Dr. Jason Lyle, Institute for Creation Research. Stay with us. You get more at ApologiaRadio.com. And we are back of Apologia TV in our makeshift studio with the bear, the girl, and me. We're Dr. Jason Lyle. And just finished talking a little bit about the problem of starlight that comes up actually a lot when you talk to atheists.
Right.
Joy, go ahead and finish up.
Yeah, I after reading a lot of Dr. Jason Lyle's articles on distant starlight, I really do like to just refer to it as distant starlight and not a problem.
Yeah.
But it's very complicated.
Yeah.
At least for me. I'm sure it's not for everyone. What I'd really like, this is for myself as well as our audience. So at the very end of the last segment, you mentioned clocks. So can you expand on that a little bit? Because as I read through articles, that's a example that you give to kind of give our human brains an idea of what that synchrony means or simultaneity.
Yeah.
So if you just want to expand on that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. Because a lot of times people will say, well, why can't you measure the one-way speed of light? And it has to do with the nature of synchronizing clocks. Two clocks are said to be synchronized if they read the same time at the same time. And it's very obvious if you're holding two clocks, one in each hand, you can see that whether they're synchronized or not, right? I mean, it's very obvious. But when they're separated by distance, it turns out to be harder to do. So how would you measure the one-way speed of light? Well, you'd need a clock You can't use a mirror anymore because we're just going to use a one-way trip. So you need a clock to tell you when to start the light beam. Let's say at 12 o'clock noon, I start my light beam, and it shines over toward another clock that's very far away. And when that other clock receives the light beam, it records the time. And so maybe it's 12:01, maybe it's 12:05, but some later time, okay? And so you say, oh, okay, maybe I launch it at noon and the other clock receives it at 12:05. And does that really mean it takes 5 minutes to get from here to there? Well, I tried this in my office. I've got my watch and my phone, and as soon as my watch struck noon, I turned on the flashlight and it went and struck the phone. And as soon as the light hit the phone's at 12:05. Now, wouldn't it be ridiculous for me to assume that it took 5 minutes for the light to get from my watch to the phone? Obviously, the reason that my phone records 12:05 is because it's 5 minutes ahead of my watch. The two clocks are not synchronized. The point is, if you don't have synchronized clocks and you try to measure the time it takes for light to get from one place to another, you're going to get a very wrong answer. And in fact, the clocks have to be exactly synchronized because light is very fast, whatever it is. And so they have to be exactly synchronized or you get the wrong answer. But it turns out it's impossible to synchronize two clocks exactly when they're separated by a distance. Now, my watch actually receives a radio pulse from Fort Collins, Colorado, which is connected to the atomic clock in Boulder. And every evening that radio pulse sends out, my watch synchronizes itself to that clock in Fort Collins. Kind of neat, I don't have to ever set it that way. But there's actually a problem there because it turns out it takes a little bit of time for the radio pulse to get from Fort Collins to my watch. No, yeah. I don't worry about that because it's a fraction of a second. But how long does it take for, how fast is radio? And it turns out radio travels at, amazingly, the speed of light. And so that's the very thing that I would like to measure is the one-way speed of light. And yet I would have to already know the one-way speed of light to know how far behind my watch is so that I could adjust it and push it forward. The other thing people will try to do is they'll say, well, maybe we can synchronize the two clocks at the same place because that's easy. And then we'll move one of them or both of them to very distant positions, the assumption being that they're still synchronized, and then we can do our experiment. But it turns out, according to Einstein, motion affects the passage of time. The very act of moving the clocks causes them to be synchronized and causes them to lose their synchronization. The time will flow at different rates. This is a tiny effect, and we don't notice it in our everyday lives because of that. But if you're going to measure something as fast as the speed of light, even those tiny effects will make a huge difference. And it turns out that there is an equation that tells you how much the clock loses or gains depending on how fast it moves. But in that equation is the one-way speed of light, the very thing that I don't know. And so it's fascinating to me that God has constructed the universe in such a way that you can never measure the one-way speed of light without synchronized clocks, and you can never exactly synchronize clocks without knowing the one-way speed of light. So we're stuck in a permanent catch-22, and it's kind of interesting that the universe has been designed that way, but God is under no obligation to make the universe intuitive, and sometimes it isn't. And so for that reason, we'll never know what the one-way speed of light is, and that suggests that it's actually a convention. It's something like time zones on Earth, where we decide that 12 o'clock noon is when the sun, we're just going to decide that when the sun is highest in the sky. And that means a different place on Earth will have a different noon. It's just as 12 o'clock central time is not the same as 12 o'clock Eastern, and so on. Something like that can occur in space. And that's how you get the light here in no time at all, actually.
Deep.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
It is. It's hard to do it in a
No, that's fantastic. Yeah, no, you explained it really, really well.
Right. Yeah, I have written some articles on that, and you can check it out on our website, icr.org, and our sister ministry, answersingenesis.org. Mm-hmm.
So I would love to, before we actually go to our end of our show here, and we're actually going to meet on the other side, right, guys, at apologiaradio.com. So if you like what you hear, we're going to be over there for the after show. Just spend a few minutes with Dr. Lyle, just kind of wrapping up over there. So apologiaradio.com, sign up for all access. You get the television show and the after show, all that content, and Apologia Academy. Dr. Lyle, about 2 minutes left here. Tell us some really cool stuff about the universe that just testifies to God's handiwork and to the glory of God. I'd love to hear that from a believer who looks at the universe with a biblical worldview. What do we see out there?
Oh, wow. And only in 2 minutes.
Well, a minute and a half.
Give us something to chew on, and then we will, on the other side, we'll do the after show and just spend a few minutes there, too.
Right.
Well, there are just all kinds of wonderful things out there. The planets, of our own solar system, we visited them all now. There are two moons
that orbit around Saturn, Janus and Epimetheus, and the difference in their orbit is only a few miles, which is less than the diameter of either moon. And yet you'd think that in 4 years the inner moon would catch up with the outer moon and collide with it. And yet these two moons every 4 years are able to avoid collision because they gravitationally pull on each other and switch orbits. It's absolutely remarkable. It's one of those things that, you know, I would never have thought of that solution, but it's brilliant. I mean, you've got these two moons that every 4 years avoid collision by swapping orbits.
Wow.
Lots of stuff like that out there in terms of just the way things move in space. It's beautiful. It's very, it's mathematical. Of course, the universe obeys mathematical laws.
I'd love to talk to you about that.
Benefit. So it's amazing stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So hang with us, guys. We're going to end here on the NRB network and all that we're doing. We're going to go over to apologiaradio.com, have a little bit of an after show with Dr. Lyle, talk about some of these things. I'd love to even ask him about that the mathematics, because it turns out you can't make sense of mathematics without the biblical worldview. And as they say in the UK, you can't make sense of maths. So we will be right back. ApologiaRadio.com is where you get us for the after show. Catch you next time.